Here we go again with another in the series of Huxley's Brave New World Order. And this is episode 5 and part 2 of Mockingbird. In this episode, we were looking again into George Orwell's life. His first wife, Eileen O'Shaughnessy, and his second wife, Sonia Brownell. With me tonight, as usual, is our Chris.
Evening.
Evening. And this is going to be a bit of a magnum opus, isn't it, Chris? to say the least.
I said that at the beginning. I saw where it was going.
Orwell's first wife was Eileen O'Shaughnessy, and she's a bit of an enigma. She was born on 25th of September, my birthday, 1905. And I wasn't born in 1905, though. And died on the 29th of March, 1945. She was born in South Shields, and I think she died in up there as well. I think she died in South Shields as well, Durham, England. Her father was Lawrence O'Shaughnessy, who was a customs collector. O'Shaughnessy attended Sunderland Church High School. At the time, Sunderland High School was a mixed private day located in Sunderland, Tyne and Wear. Founded in 1883 as the oldest girls' senior school in Sunderland, it's now owned by the United Church Schools Trust. Sunderland High School actually closed in 2016, where Eileen O'Shaughnessy went. And the United Church Schools Trust is one of the 100 largest UK charitable organisations in the UK. The charity is operating under the name United Learning as of 2012. United Learning is one of the 10 largest charities with the most employees in the UK. Age 19 in the autumn of 1924, O'Shaughnessy entered St Hugh's College, Oxford, where she studied English. There she received a higher second class degree. I think possibly she was taught by C.S. Lewis as well,
right,
and Tolkien. So there's again the mix where she's marrying in.
To a new fiction guy.
Aldous Huxley died on the same day. C.S. Lewis. It's a strange mix. According to what I've read about her life, by choice, there followed a succession of jobs of no special consequence. We've all been there. And with no connection from one to the next. Jobs which she held briefly and which began with work as an assistant mistress at the Silchester House, an all-girls boarding school in Taplow in Thames Valley, and included being a secretary. She was also a reader for the elderly Dame Elizabeth Cadbury, with more chocolate links there, if you remember, right, in the last one, fries, chocolate and what have you came up. And obviously that links back to the plantation type things where...
Yeah, sugar, yeah.
And where... and cocoa. Where Orwell's great-great-great-grandfather, Blair, was owned a plantation there.
Hmm.
So maybe there is some kind of link or a setup of getting these two together. O'Shaughnessy was also the proprietor of an office in Victoria Street, London, for typing and secretarial work. When it closed down, she took up freelance journalism, selling an occasional feature piece to the Evening News. And she also helped her brother, Lawrence, who was a thoracic surgeon, by typing, proofreading, and editing his scientific papers and books. In the autumn of 1934, Eileen enrolled in the University College London for a 2-year graduate course in educational psychology, leading to a Master of Arts qualification. Although I've also read a conflicting story that said she left early when she married Orwell and gained no qualifications. That's another thing you seem to find is that...
Contradicting stories.
Yeah. The University of London psychology department at the time, O'Shaughnessy was there, was headed by Sir Cyril Lodwick Burt. Burt's father, also Cyril, initially kept a chemist shop to support his family while he studied medicine. He became an assistant house surgeon at Westminster Hospital, London. One of Cyril Burt's famous patients was Darwin Galton, he's another mix, brother of eugenicist Sir Francis Galton. The Burts made visits to the Galton estate, which allowed the young Burt to learn about the work of Sir Francis Galton, who also allowed Burt to meet him on multiple occasions and to be strongly drawn to his ideas, especially studies in statistics and individual differences, two defining characters of the London School of Psychology, whose membership includes both Galton and Burt. Remember, the Galton and Darwins are married into the Huxleys, and Thomas Huxley was known as Darwin's bulldog. In another twist, Chris, Sir Francis Galton lived and died in Haslemere, Surrey.
All right. That's where I said we used to live.
Yeah.
Where they did the what is it?
Yeah. Haslemere was the place where the BBC's Hannah Fry, is that more chocolate links, presented Contagion, the BBC 4 pandemic exercise, about the possible impact of a flu pandemic in 2018.
Yeah.
The programme used Haslemere, Surrey as the site of the first simulated infection, and coincidentally, in February 2020, the town saw the first recorded case of a person contracting 91 Divock from within the UK.
Did a whole show about that thing, didn't we?
Yeah. Another coincidence.
And that was the beginning of the track and trace app.
Yes.
That's when they were trying out in that TV show.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. In July 2022, Fry presented the BBC doc Unjabbed or Unvaccinated, in which she investigated why a portion of the British population remained unjabbed against 91 Divock. Anna Fry also went to UCL. Just like Cyril Burt, Eileen O'Shaughnessy, and several others in this story, they also went to UCL. Fry is a professor of mathematics of cities at the UCL Centre for Advanced Spatial Analysis. She studies the patterns of human behaviour, such as interpersonal relationships and dating, and how mathematics can apply to them.
Jelly beans.
Jelly beans, yeah. The Centre for Advanced Spatial Analysis, CASA, CASA, is a research centre in the UCL, which specialises in the application and visualisation of spatial analytic techniques and simulation models to cities and regions. The centre is active in exploring how the Internet of Things can be deployed in large urban areas, linking objects in the built environment through the Internet technologies. The centre specialises in urban informatics, geospatial intelligence, geographic information systems, urban modelling, the application of smart city technology, and complexity science. Sounds like 15-minute cities, Chris. Back to Cyril Burt, who, as I said, spent time at the Francis Galton Estate, which was in Haslemere. Despite his lasting reputation as a statistical psychologist, Sir Cyril Burt was also involved in psychoanalysis. He was a member of the Tavistock Clinic Council in the early 1930s and of the British Psychoanalytical Society. Burt was elected president of the British Psychological Society. Burt was also a member of the British Eugenics Society.
Every box ticked.
Tick, tick, tick. Now called the Adelphi Genetics Forum that we mentioned in the last one, and we mentioned it before, I think, but he would have definitely known Sir Julian Huxley. Remember, Julian Huxley was president and chief executive. Anyway, were president and vice president, I think, of the Eugenics Society at different points. So these people are all intertwined. That's not any mad thinking on our behalf. They are intertwined. Burt suggested on radio in 1946 the formation of an organisation for people with high IQ scores. He was made an honorary president of Mensa in 1960.
Right. So did he invent Mensa?
Yes. He came up with the idea that we should be testing people with high IQ scores, which seems quite benign until you realise that he was a member of the British Eugenics Society and into psychoanalytical
almost
evaluation.
Like he's putting out a big fishing net there just to... Well, I suppose it's like anything, isn't it? Grabbing talent, I suppose.
Well, the grabbing talent that...
Or genuine intelligence.
Well, again...
Rather than...
Yeah.
Surface intelligence, you know.
Well, whether it's genuine intelligence or surface intelligence...
I don't know if, yeah.
The questions that will be asked from a Mensa perspective to say you've got an IQ...
Yeah.
Are all following the mantra, aren't they?
Psychological questions, probably, yeah. I would as a guess.
And if you fail, that means you're a pleb. But you're not necessarily a pleb.
It just means you don't fit into their world.
Into that box, yes.
Yeah.
And you might not fit into their world either. Doesn't mean to say that, you never know, Mensa might mean you're a psycho.
But if those IQ questions, which I've never done, I've got no idea, I've got no interest in that stuff, But if those questions are to test your IQ, what's your IQ mean? You know, and I think that's what you're trying to say is it could just mean that you're pliable or you can be used or it could mean anything, couldn't it?
Could, yeah. But what we've got is at the time that Orwell's first wife, before he knew her,
yeah,
is studying psychology
yeah.
with a guy who's a eugenicist and he came up with Mensa.
Yeah.
And he's heading up the psychology department at the same time.
And they've got the word IQ on everyone's. Everyone knows that word.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's
yeah. Oh, he's a member of Mensa. She's a member of Mensa.
He's got an IQ of this. He's got an IQ.
Yeah, he's got an IQ of 100 or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. So Cyril Burt published numerous articles and books on a host of topics like behavior genetics, most notably in studying the heritability of intelligence as measured in IQ tests. Using twin studies as well. We always need a couple of
right.
twins.
Good old Nazi good twin old. Studies.
Hopefully they were blonde and blue.
I'm going to say all blonde.
That created the most controversy, that was the twin studies, frequently referred to as the Burt Affair. It has been generally accepted that he fabricated some of the data. Don't be doing that. Maybe Professor Ferguson will. The first research project that was to define Burt's life work in quantitative intelligence testing, eugenics, and the inheritance of intelligence. So the twin testing was part of that.
He's not sounding like a very nice fellow, this fella, to be fair.
No, yeah. One of the conclusions in his 1909 paper was that the upper class children in private preparatory schools did better in the tests than those in the ordinary elementary schools, and that the difference was innate, meaning intelligence was existing in or belonging to or determined by factors present in an individual from birth.
I'm really shocked that he came up with that conclusion, aren't you?
Yeah, considering them poor kids are probably working in a workhouse.
Yeah, or in a fucking covered in soot cleaning the chimney.
Exactly, yeah. I mean that all that's been obviously proven nonsense now. That
yeah, but that's the eugenics thought process there, isn't it?
It is. But I mean, if you think about the eugenics movement, a lot of these people aren't. Look at Boris Johnson. You wouldn't say he was intelligent, but it wouldn't surprise me if he had a high IQ. I mean, and he's just a pathological liar. Yeah. And again, for me, this is what we're seeing through this research. And what it's done for me is I can't say this is about religion. I can't say it's just about what family you've been born into. I think there's something more than that. And I think I keep coming back to what you said about the Damien Omen film, where because it really resonates that. Because you could just be an ordinary guy. Yeah.
That fits into what we've talked about before, which is that the king with his illegitimate kids living in the village.
Yeah.
And even though the kid didn't know it, he's still getting looked after and spoon-fed jobs, etc. Do you know what I mean? I'm making that up, but it kind of fits into the same scenario, doesn't it, in your mind?
But do you know, like, there's a favourite, you know, and you can't work out why. Say you're in class and there's a favourite and you just don't understand why. Or a parent has a favourite, or an uncle has a favourite of a nephew or whatever it might be. There's some sort of connection to this system, to this parasite, if you like, that draws this person to this situation like a moth to a flame. Yet other ones in his family or her family aren't drawn the same way. And well, they could all go to Oxford, for argument's sake, as well.
They could choose them because they see, when they're kids, they could see that lack of empathy.
Yes, yeah.
And or that psychotic gene, you know. I know you don't want to slag off kids, but we've all met kids. I always see kids as like adults. You get on with some and you don't get on with others. Some you shine to, some you don't shine to. And you've all met those kids who are a little bit too aggressive at too younger age.
Yeah.
You know.
But is it just about that kind of aggression? Because you could get someone who isn't outwardly pulling flies' wings off, for argument's sake, and spiders' legs.
I used to do that. Yeah. What a horrible little bastard. Yeah.
But what I'm trying to say is maybe it's not the aggression as in physical aggression. You don't have to be physically aggressive to send 50,000 people out of a trench.
Yeah, no, I was making that up as an example. Fact, what I mean is maybe they see something that we don't see.
Yeah, yeah, maybe they can be trained easier. Again, coming back to that MK Ultra,
or in like that Godfather scenario, like in the film Godfather, where Marlon Brando, well, Godfather knows, you think it's going to be Sonny who's going to be the leader of the gang, but he always knew he was going to be Michael, even though he didn't want to be anything to do with it. He saw the potential.
And he didn't really want him to have anything to do with it.
And nobody knew he was the right man for the job.
Because
he was cold.
Yeah. And that, to me, all these things, you know, when like Mark's research, even Dave McGowan's and things like that, when we're talking about these military backgrounds, these people going to Oxford or born into these families, there's something more than just that. That's where I'm getting the feeling. Because not all these people... right, are evil. I think a lot of them have been traumatized, but not all of them. It's just impossible. They can't be. And I'm not even saying George Orwell's evil.
Yeah? Well, maybe it's not.
Or Aldous Huxley. But for some reason, they're willing to carry something through and pass that baton on to the next person who's carrying it through.
Maybe it's just another way of life that we will never understand.
Yeah.
Like in 1984, where the proles and... like I've said this before, I think, Fai, that the Winstons aren't us. Because when you read that, you think, we're the Winstons. We're not the Winstons. We're the proles. Yeah. Winstons are probably an actor or a TV presenter or a politician. Because even in 1984, as we're talking about it, Winston's the guy who is an editor of news, isn't he? He drops everything down the memory hole.
Yeah.
So he's, I suppose, what you call now, he's the Mariara Spring. Propagandize. Oh, but he didn't even want to do that job, and he knows it's wrong, but he's still dropping news down the memory hole.
Yeah.
So the equivalent of that would be a newsreader, for the previous nonsense. Maybe the same things, they know it's wrong, but there's a hold on them that they can't ignore.
Yeah. It's certainly an interesting conversation because I think there's something more than just, for argument's sake, Jim Morrison's dad were an admiral. I think there's something more to it than... because there were loads of admirals. Why Jim Morrison? Yeah. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily just... I know that's a factor. I'm not saying it's... I'm not trying to play down or take away from David McGowan's work, because that was fantastic work. But...
no, but also... you
understand
like, as an example, he's an admiral, but maybe he's an admiral who's a Satanist.
Yeah.
Maybe the other admiral isn't, and he is, and he's part of that gang. So he's in the gang of a gang of a gang.
Yeah,
And maybe he didn't
of the 1% of the 1%.
Exactly. And maybe he didn't, I mean, I don't want to, you know, but it is that pyramid level, isn't it? But even maybe on a more of an extreme than we've ever discussed.
Yes. And that's what I'm trying to get at. There's something, I'm calling it the Prometheus bloodline. Forget people going about, it's Jewish people's fault, it's Muslims' fault, it's this.
Bollocks.
And I just think that's absolute nonsense.
Well, but that comes into... That comes into the fact that there's no countries. The countries are for us to squabble and argue about. Religions are for us to squabble and argue about.
Well,
somewhere there's something else, which is maybe even the Masonic things for us to squabble and argue and point fingers at, whatever. Maybe there's an elite or a percent, and it's something else, you know. Maybe it is a demonic, maybe it's something else. But that's what, and they're filtering down what. And I do think that getting us to do stuff, i.e. go to war, like you say, get out the trenches and shoot people, or give out certain medical procedures. Maybe that is the score. It's not that they actually even lift their hand to anything. We do it for them. And that is the ultimate...
slavery.
The ultimate slavery and the ultimate signing of the contract.
Yes.
We're signing contracts all the time, aren't we, by agreeing to things. And even, say you're an assassin, right? Like in a film, and you're going to assassinate someone. You've done that for someone who's told you to do it. They haven't got their hands dirty.
And you've also done it for someone who's told you to do it that can whack you as well.
Well, exactly. But maybe they don't even get... And like recently, through the jibby jabs, they've got people who've trained to do it, to dish this out. I mean, it must be the ultimate hand rub, you know, the ultimate.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
Oh, I don't know. You just have a vision of some...
the ultimate... You know,
we have got people who have trained and sworn to look after people, to damage people. I mean, on a fucking karmic level, that is evil genius.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and like we said right at the beginning, they would be the first ones they throw under the bus.
Well, yeah, well, like your Winstons, they're probably less. They're probably more precautious.
I don't even think doctors are the Winstons. I think it's, or maybe they are. I suppose they are, aren't they? Yeah. Anyway, just chatting. I don't know.
Yeah. All right.
we know nothing.
But throughout this research, that's what's occurred to me and Chris, as you can hear him talking about it as well, that there's something behind all this. I mean, people. Yeah, we can take a lineage back to Frankfurt and look at bloodlines there. We can take a lineage back to Robert the Bruce and further back and all. Mm. And yeah, we see all this and they all are aligned to it. And it interests me. Mm. But there's something more behind that that's controlling this. And that the chosen ones, helped by successful peasants, which is probably a Winston, hungry for entry into this secret club that they never get to. They're never going to get there. They're not one of them ever. Yeah. You know, a successful peasant is not going to get into that secret club.
Wancock springs to mind.
Wancock. They're not going to get into that secret club.
You remember when we did the Johnson stuff?
Yeah.
And it almost seemed like, we don't know any of this for a fact, but it almost seemed like his dad was buying into the club.
Mm.
He wasn't part of the club. Was he bloodline fire?
Who, his dad?
Johnson's.
Johnson's, I think it was through his mother.
I think his mother.
Illegitimate line.
So again
maybe, that's a proper Damien Omen line. Yeah. You know, it's that type of line,
maybe,
isn't it?
Maybe back in his day, he was hungry for it and married into it and then drove that poor woman nuts. Who knows? I mean,
yeah, who knows?
Like we said before, is there different factions of these psychos?
I'm sure there are. I'm sure there's several factions.
Their egos are too big not to have in fighting. Yeah. That's for a fact.
But again, the Prometheus, whatever it is, whether it's whatever you class as an alien or an entity or something or some things, different ones.
Driving them along.
Doesn't care. It's the trading place's dollar bet. Look at Johnson and Cameron fighting. You know, they don't care. It's irrelevant to them.
Yeah. Somewhere in the background behind that big heavy red velvet curtain, maybe there's an agreement that no matter what happens, they're not allowed to actually tell the truth of what is happening.
Yeah. Well, that's the Machiavellian parasite, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the Machiavellian parasite. Anyway, back to this Cyril Burt. In 1913, Burt took a part-time position as a school psychologist for the London County Council. So this eugenicist became a psychologist for a school for London County Council with the responsibility of picking out the feeble-minded children in accordance with the Mental Deficiency Act of 1913. This is in Britain.
Right. So the beginning of the actual sterilisation, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Incidentally, the Mental Deficiency Act of 1913 was an act of Parliament here in the UK creating provisions for the institutional treatment of people deemed to be feeble-minded or morally defective.
Right. What does that mean?
Well,
it depends.
Means that anything they want it to mean, Chris?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, exactly.
It proposed an institutional separation so that mental defectives should be taken out of poor law institutions and prisons into newly established colonies.
What, abroad?
So if you remember, I mean, that's the Nazis' take. Maybe this were a plan then and it didn't work and they allowed the Germans to try and do it.
Yeah.
Or the communists or whoever. Well, I mean,
it was England talked about it. America did it to an extent. And then the Germans copied it, didn't they? Is that right?
Well, the Germans certainly. Well,
Americans actually did it, though, didn't they?
Yeah, the Americans did it, yes. Yeah.
Sterilized who they thought wasn't.
The feeble minded.
Feeble minded, yeah. And it's funny we talk about this now because today, for some reason, this popped in my head was, you know, the whole mental health thing that they've got people. Again, they've got people actually signing up for it themselves, not being deemed mentally ill. They've got people now talking about their own mental health.
Yeah.
Quite openly.
And euthanasia.
And euthanasia. And signing up for drugs, saying I've got mental health. I mean,
I'm on the spectrum. I'm on the spectrum.
But people are actually, instead of it used to be you got your finger pointed at you, you got a finger pointed at you, and then you ended up being labelled mental health. People are openly saying I've got mental. I mean, no disrespect to anyone, but I spoke to a young lad working in where I was working, And he said he was going to the doctors, blah, blah, blah. And I said, what are you going to the doctors for? And he said, oh, it's just mental health stuff. So what I mean is people are signing up for this mental health thing. And if you remember a few years ago when they brought in the thing where you don't have to be labelled mental by two doctors, just one, etc. Is this lining up for something in the future, Fi, where you've now got a history of mental health problems, even though you maybe you haven't or maybe have whatever. But
what does that mean, though?
Well, it didn't mean anything. I'm just saying.
No, I know you know that, but
yeah.
I'm being general in my terminology.
No, but what I'm saying is, what is it lining up for in the future? So now they've got.
Well, we know, don't
they've
we?
Got, they've got. They've got. They've got 30 out of 100 kids who've now got mental health issues, and they've actually owned up to it themselves, and they're on the register, etc.
Well, we can thank Prince William and Premier League footballers for sitting in a changing room with sweaty socks lying around and football boots with mud on them and stuff, admitting that they're suffering from mental illness.
Yeah,
on BBC.
Well, I would be if my dad had whacked my mum. I'd be fucking having mental health issues as well.
Yeah, exactly. Interesting. The bill for this pool, what did I call the bill? The Mental Deficiency Act of 1913. One of the people that voted against it. There were only three that voted against it. Three MPs. Remind you of anything back in 2020? voted against it. One of them was Baron Josiah Wedgwood, a relative of the Huxley family and a proud Zionist. So he voted against this, but he was a Zionist anyway. The University College London, Tavistock. Remember, this guy worked at Tavistock. He was there at the early epicenter of Tavistock.
I mean, knowing what we know now, you would hazard a guess that they just threw in a couple of objectors just to make it look like.
Quite possibly. Or maybe maybe they knew there were going to be a couple of objectors. Who knows, right? Mm. It's sort of irrelevant, isn't it? But can you believe they actually passed that? When I saw that, I thought, I can't even believe that. I never even heard of it. I didn't realise they'd done that in Britain. I knew they'd done it in America or in some states.
Well, I think I remember hearing that the Americans got it. We started it and they took it.
Oh, definitely. Francis Galton started it.
Yeah.
And Darwin, they started. Yeah. They kick-started eugenics.
Yeah.
As was going to come on later on in the series.
Yeah, and the Americans were in, I mean, sorry, the Nazis were in admiration of the Americans and us for
Nazis were in admiration of Sir Francis Galton.
But then again, like we said, if there's no countries and it's just a system they want to get in place and they want to see how it works out, it doesn't matter if they were Nazis, Americans, or
it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, again, now that's one thing. In my instinct, that is one thing I'm pretty sure of.
As we covered with Dr. Ewan Cameron, right, who was part of the cleaning up of Germany in the Nuremberg trials. Yeah. He went to question all these horrible Nazis who were experimenting, and they came up with these laws that you can't experiment on. Then he went back to Canada via Scotland and started experimenting on people with LSD and tying them down and electrocuting them and stuff.
Yeah.
Might
as well, though.
But all these colleges, Eton, Imperial College London. Now, the one thing I will say, and not everybody who goes to Eton is, in fact, 99.99%, I'm sure, of people that go to Eton are nice people. Yeah?
Of course.
That 1% of 1% that have been traumatised or recruited into security services.
By having these schools, Oxford, Cambridge, Eton, it's not the fact that they are, I mean, the gangsters, as we've talked about before, but you're putting all the people in one place.
Yes.
So, i.e. the most learned, whatever, or from the families or whatever, all in one place so you can watch them and then choose which ones you choose to do what.
As we've seen.
Just quickly, something that popped in my head today, so I'm going to mention it just because it popped in my head today. You know that the 7/7 bombings, one of the buses blew up in Tavistock Square?
Yeah.
I mean, and I remember the images of the bus destroyed, and in the background you can see
Tavistock.
Tavistock, yeah.
And as we know, let's not forget Tavistock is, as we speak, the place to go for gender reassignment.
Well, not now, because they closed it down, didn't they?
Well, sort of.
Apparently they went too far.
Yeah, sort of, yeah. This shows the multi-generational nature of what we're dealing with. You're talking of somebody who worked for Eugenics Society, was working for Psychoanalytical Societies, was at the University College London. This was the person heading up George Orwell's future wife's training in psychology. And again, I'll say this again, I think we mentioned it last time, both Aldous Huxley and George Orwell's wives I don't know if it was Aldous's second or first, but it was both were married to psychologists or psychotherapists.
And also, in fact, you're saying about the second wives, it was quite rare for people to get divorced in them days and then remarried. Mm. That wasn't, I'm making this up because I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that wasn't a regular thing.
But one other thing that comes across, especially in this one about Orwell, is most of these people had open relationships.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like said that Orwell had an open relationship, his wife had an open
relationship. But you imagine that in the 80s, never mind when these guys were knocking around.
I know.
That were, you know, everything was religious, everything. Yeah. The whole country was run on religion still.
Yeah.
Even back when
that's my opinion of it. That's what I thought it was. And as we pointed out in part one of Mockingbird, Sir David Petre, who was the Director General of MI5, our own internal security service from 1941 to 1946, Petre worked in the Imperial Indian Police, or Indian Imperial Police, between 1900 and 1936, at the same time as Orwell did. So all these things where, you know, Cambridge, Oxford, we've already shown that they were recruiting professors at these places. And, you know, then he goes to India and is working at the same time. So anyway, there are always these links, these tentative links there that you can't solidly prove that he knew the Director General of MI5, but he ended up working for security agencies over here for quite a period of his life, if he was alive. Eileen O'Shaughnessy was at University College London with a lady called Elsvita Fenn, pen name of Lydia Jackson Jaburovich, who was a fellow student who became one of O'Shaughnessy's closest friends. They met for the first time at UCL. She said that Eileen, who was 28 years old at the time and looked several years younger, she was tall and slender, shoulders were rather broad and high. She had blue eyes and dark brown, naturally wavy hair. George said to her that she had a cat's face. And one could see that this was true in a most attractive sense. Elsvita Fenn was also a pseudonym. She had three names. Real name was Lydia Valitva Zaburovich, a Russian-born daughter of a Tsarist official who emigrated to England in 1925 after the Russian Revolution. That's some time after the Russian Revolution. I know it went on a while, all the aftershocks and that. Anyway, she obtained a DPhil in psychology from Oxford University in 1949 and focused her practice on child psychology and psychotherapy. She also worked for the BBC in the 60s. So just like that, she enters a country and goes on to study child psychology and psychotherapy at UCL, Oxford. And this was way before 1949, by the way. This was talking mid-30s, early 30s, yeah? When she was at UCL. And she just happens to be at the same place as Eileen O'Shaughnessy. And there's another bit to this as well, which is quite interesting. We can see clear influence that Cyril Burt had on Eileen O'Shaughnessy. She was also particularly interested in testing intelligence in children and quite early decided upon to use this subject for the thesis she would be writing. This is something else that Orwell, as I said, had in common with Aldous Huxley, both married psychologists / psychotherapists. She was very close to her elder brother. He was a surgeon. And she described her brother as one of nature's fascists. So she's left-wing, he's a fascist. Brought up in the same family. He was apparently killed in the retreat to Dunkirk. Eileen met Orwell in 1935. At the time, Orwell was living at 77 Parliament Hill in Hampstead, occupying a spare room, so here we go again with a story that is poor, right, in first floor flat of a lady called Rosalind Henschel Obermeyer. Now, she's an interesting character as well as this lady. Rosalind Henschel Obermeyer decided to throw a party and invited her friend Eileen, whom she knew from her psychology courses at UCL. So she also went to UCL. So let's just have a quick recap. Orwell was renting a room from Rosalind Henschel Obermeyer, who was a would-be psychologist, who invited her friend from UCL, fellow psychologist O'Shaughnessy, to meet with Orwell, both trained by UCL professor Cyril Burt, who was a Tavistock eugenicist.
It's interesting that they have all this information logged. Because, I mean, how much information about our family do you have logged anywhere?
Yeah, not much. Not
so it's,
much.
It's logged. And also,
one it's of my... logged as well in odd different places that you've got to pull together as well.
Yeah. But the fact that it exists, though, Fire, how much information could you find out about our grandma?
Very little.
Zero. And also, you just think of the fact that they could actually hide anything. Whereas now, not so much with the internet and, you know, cameras, social media, etc. But then they could get away with anything, couldn't they?
Yeah.
So what I mean is, like, going back to Orwell's wife, where she's flitting from job and colleges and da-da-da, no one would have...
been interested in that.
No one would have been interested or noticed or thought anything about it. Because she's seen the groundwork being built for now, aren't it?
Yeah.
So there's no reason to be interested in it.
No. Oh, Shaughnessy and Orwell were married in 1936 on June 9th. At St. Mary's Church, Wallington, Hertfordshire. Obermeyer, my lady where he rented his room from, was a niece of a famous conductor and composer, Sir George Henschel, whose grandmother was Henriette Henschel, maiden name Frankenstein, born Dresden, Saxony, Germany. His stepmother was Charlotte Henschel, who was an Oppenheim.
What, as in nuclear bomb Oppenheim?
Well, I don't know. I didn't do the genealogy on that, but I know they come from Frankfurt, so... Well, that name comes from Frankfurt, so...
I don't know many Oppenheims.
No, but the Oppenheimer Diamonds as well, so there's a quite famous family, more than the Oppenheimer.
All right, so maybe it's a name,
Yeah. So George Henschel made records, music records. He was a composer, as I said, as late as 1928 for the Columbia Graphophone Company. Remember that from the first one we talked about, Chris?
Yeah.
One of the earliest gramophone companies in the UK, founded in 1917 as an offshoot to American Columbia Phonograph Company. That's some right names going back then, didn't we? We spoke about these in episode one, but I'm going to go into something here because it leads on to something else. Columbia Records is an American record label owned by Sony Music Entertainment, a subsidiary of Sony Corporation of America, the Northwest division of the Japanese conglomerate Sony. Today valued at $100 billion, and it's one of the top 100 companies in the world. This is where the research goes off on a bit of a tangent, but ends up tying back up again with mind control operations and its origin and uses on different generations using electricity, telecoms, and broadcasting as weapons. Well, so, for a few... What do you say? Go on.
No, I'm going to say, well, brainwashing, Columbia Records, Columbia Films, Sony Films. I mean, you can get any more brainwashing, could you, than that?
Apparently, Chris.
Is that Columbia ISIS Diana, I guess?
Yeah, probably. So, for a few minutes, I'm going to indulge the conspiracy nut job in me and Chris and divert our attention away and then come back full circle to the Huxleys and Orwell. If you can remember, we mentioned in episode one, the Graphophone Company was the name and trademark of an improved version of the phonograph invented by Thomas Edison in 1887, which was funded by J.P. Morgan. Edison developed many devices in fields such as electric power generation. If you, all right, everyone says that were nonsense. It was Tesla, but let's just go with this for the moment. And that was the General Electric Company, or GE. He also invented mass communication, sound recording, and motion pictures, all funded by J.P. Morgan, just quickly funded in turn by the Rothschilds.
Just quickly to cover that Tesla caveat, because we're... I think General Electric funded him, didn't they?
Yes.
And then when he died...
Tesla were funded by J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan and General Electric. Yeah. When he died, they just took all his stuff.
Yes.
Just before anyone mentions that, because they will.
Yeah. Edison was also a eugenicist. Seems to be a theme running through here. Eugenics, the idea of creating better citizens, became popular in the 1880s.
Better citizens, not killing anyone.
Are you a better citizen? No.
Yeah.
Eugenics, the idea of eugenics ideas were embraced by scientists, politicians, feminists, because they cared, and many others, including President Woodrow Wilson, Thomas Edison, and Alexander Graham Bell. The graphophone was an improvement, as I said, on the gramophone, and was invented by Volta Laboratory, established by eugenicist Alexander Graham Bell. To have two eugenicists controlling early frequencies technologies, I don't think should be underplayed with hindsight, do you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Edison also controlled the electricity power, and Graham Alexander Bell the Bell telephone company that was AT&T.
Right. And you think of that Steiner thing, don't you?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. We mentioned that Alexander Bell was mentioned in Shelby Downer's book, The Cannibals of Life and Death, and him being on Jekyll Island, which is...
Sorry, that's what I meant to say, Shelby Downer, not Steiner. Yeah. Sorry.
Also backed by J.P. Morgan Rockefeller at the Masonic ritual sex magic orgies involving children on Jekyll Island at the Jekyll Island Club.
Right, bloody hell.
Yeah, I know. This is... and that's why that first episode now seems important when you'd start adding this stuff to it. Mm. And I know that we're only talking because that guy, Henschel, the composer, made records for Columbia, but it's amazing how you link off into this stuff. It's yeah.
Like you said, that Shelby Downer book about Bell being on Jekyll Island. I mean, yeah, all creeper, all matches together.
The Jekyll Island Club was a private club on Jekyll Island on Georgia's Atlantic coast. It was founded in 1886 when members of an incorporated hunting and recreation club. The club thrived through the early 20th century. Its members came from many of the world's wealthiest families, most notably Morgans, Rockefellers, and Vanderbilts. Jekyll Island was the location of the famous meeting in 1910, in which the draft legislation was written to create a central banking system for the United States. Following the panic of 1907, banking reform became a major issue in the US. Senator Nelson Aldrich was the guy that led it, and he's a relation of the Rockefellers as well, Aldrich. They were married intertwined with the Aldriches and the Rockefellers. The first telephone line across the United States participated from Jekyll Island.
Do you think that's why we've got the Jekyll and Hyde story, though?
No, Jekyll and Hyde comes from a British family called Jekyll.
Yeah, I've told this before.
Yeah, and I was going to go into that, but it deserves more time spent on it than just a little snippet. But there's
a family of
Jekylls.
Yeah.
And Jekyll Island was called after one of them.
Right, okay. Yeah. So there is a link then.
Yeah, there is definitely a link, yeah.
Right.
There's two sets of families. One of them, the Jekyll story was based on, and the other side, the island was named after.
But why make a story up about, an evil version of the like a
Robert Louis Stevenson, wasn't it?
Yeah, Treasure Island guy. Yeah,
yeah.
Basically, he, split person.
He wrote it about his friend.
I've read that book. Yeah. It's only a short story actually.
One of the Jekylls, she was a famous gardener. Anyways, it went into some. We were talking about architecture being and Masonic sand, and this guy who was her friend, who she introduced from landscape gardening. Right. I forget her first name now. I wish I'd put it in now. She, she introduced this guy in who became Sir something or other, and he built all the famous buildings in India and a lot of them in London as well. On January 2015, Theodore N. Vail, the first president of AT&T, participated from Jekyll Island in the opening of the first telephone line across the United States. Which brings us back nicely to Alexander Bell, who co-founded AT&T in 1885. His trademark usage was acquired successively by the Volta Graphophone Company, then the American Graphophone Company, the North American Phonograph Company, and finally Columbia Phonograph Company, known today as Columbia Records. In March 1925, Louis Sterling, backed by J.P. Morgan, acquired controlling interest in the parent company, Columbia US. The repercussions of the stock market crash of 1929, again backed by J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, stroke Rothschilds, led to huge losses in the recording industry. And in March 1931, J.P. Morgan, as a major shareholder, steered Columbia Graphophone Company, along with Odeon Records and Parlophone, which it owned since 1926, into a merger with the Graphophone Company, known as HMV, to form a company called Electrical Musical Industries Limited, or as we know it today, EMI.
Bloody hell.
Sir Isaac Schoenberg, born 1880, died 1963, another 1963 death, was an electronics engineer born in Belarus and was best known for his role in the history of television. He was the head of EMI research that developed the 405 line on the Marconi-EMI system. the first fully electronic television system to be used in regular broadcasting when it was introduced with the BBC Television Service in 1936. It was later adopted by other TV organisations around the world. This is 1984 in full effect.
Just listen to that, Fatty, right? It does make you think, doesn't it, right? And I'm going to talk crazy talk here. Crazy air talk, should I say. And then you think about the beginnings of TV and radio, etc. And then you think now where we are with tablets, flat screens, whatever. And then you've got all these names saying they invented these things. And like we were saying about a force behind all this stuff, was this information just given to someone to pass down to us? Because who invented the flat screen? Who invented the touch screen? Who invented the iPhone?
Yeah. There's no...
It wasn't Steve Jobs, was it?
No, it wasn't Steve Jobs, no.
No.
They haven't had to pay licenses for them.
No.
You don't see Apple saying we made all this money, but a lot of it went back to the inventor
And Samsung copied us, so we're going to sue them.
Yeah, but everyone's got the flat screen. Everyone's got
they
it.
They just appeared. They appeared in 2009.
Yeah, they're not fighting over in court saying we invented that. No, we invented that. It was given to them by DARPA or someone like that from somewhere. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or DARCA.
DARPA. Take this Black Mirror. He doesn't
make it in the world of inventions. It doesn't make any sense, does it?
No. And it's one of them inventions, like electricity.
Yeah, and television, I suppose, to an extent, and
frequencies,
telephone,
controlling the frequencies.
I mean, they put Bell on the telephone thing. But really, you know,
and he just happened to be called Bell.
Yeah, no, Bell End.
As head of research at EMI, Schoenenberg was a chap called Alan Blumenlein's supervisor when Blumenlein invented stereophonic sound in 1931. Blumenlein died, I'm probably going to get destroyed for pronouncing that wrong, but anyway, there you go, during World War II on the 7th of June, 1942, aged 38, during a secret trial of the H2S airborne radar system that was then under development. When all on board the Halifax bomber were killed when it crashed in Wales, or Welsh Bicknor, in Herefordshire. Blumenlein was so central to development of the H2S airborne radar system to aid bomb targeting that after his death, many believed the project would fail. However, it survived and was the factor in shortening World War II. Here again, we see that people working for the military on secret electronic experiments, who then went on to head up the new communications equipment beaming frequencies under the guise of TV radio broadcasts into the homes of billions around the world. These were weapons of war at one point that were then aimed at us from places like the BBC. Mm.
Then you think about like Enlil Muirmast, don't you, Fer?
Yeah. Enlil Muirmast and all them masts like that just remind me of Triffids. I don't know why. It just...
Well, look at the Enlil Muirmast and the other masts that you see like that. Then look at the modern 5G towers that you see. They look very sinister. You're driving down a road, and I've pointed out to my miss, I'm like, look at that. Where the hell did that come from?
Yeah, it just popped up overnight.
As a human being, you're driving down the road and you see one, you're like, my God, where did that come from? Yeah. The solid, scary looking fucking...
They're putting them up overnight when people are asleep, Chris. In 1905, Sir Isaac Schoenenberg was employed to design and install the earliest wireless stations in Russia. Sure. However, in 1914, Schoenenberg decided to emigrate to London and join the Marconi Wireless and Telegraph Company. In 1919, he became a British subject. Just like that, to make him a British subject. He would probably have known a man called Peter Pendleton Eckersley, who was one of the founders of the BBC. Eckersley was a pioneer of British broadcasting. Eckersley was the first chief engineer of the British Broadcasting Company Limited from 1922 to 1927, and chief engineer of the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, until 1929. In World War I, Eckersley was sent to the Wireless Experimental Station at Biggin Hill, where he conducted experimental work on duplex telephony for aircraft. He joined Marconi's Wireless Telegraph Company as the head of experimental section, aircraft department, or sorry, the experimental section of the aircraft department, where he designed the Croydon Airport Ground Station Transmitter, His elder brother was physicist Thomas Exler. Why do I mention Peter Pendleton Eckersley? Well, they were sons of a man called William Eckersley, a civil engineer. Civil. William Eckersley married a lady called Rachel Huxley. Rachel Huxley was the fifth child of Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Henry Huxley, which would make Sir Julian and Aldous Huxley and Sir Andrew Huxley direct first cousins of the man who helped to set up the BBC.
It's all starting to look like shenanigans.
Orwell also worked for the BBC.
That's a fact, because I've seen that picture with that giant microphone that says BBC on top.
Yeah, we've seen pictures of it. In fact, on the 7th of November 2017, a statue of George Orwell was unveiled in the piazza of the BBC's new broadcasting house by Baroness Whittaker and Orwell's son, Richard Blair. So he's now got a statue in the BBC.
Right.
But there's no known recordings of him.
Have you seen that statue? I've never seen that statue.
No, I've never seen it. I've not seen it. George Orwell worked for the BBC during World War II, 1941 to 1943, as talks producer on what was then the Eastern Service, writing and programming what was essentially propaganda for broadcast to the Indian subcontinent at a crucial time during the war. That paragraph came from the Orwell Society website.
Right, so he was a propagandist, wasn't he?
No, he was a fantastic genius author that came out of nowhere. Yeah. Right, I want to go off into Mike Williams and Mark Devlin territory here, right? I'm going into the Beatles, right? This is a side note, this is a proper side swipe. However, it does bring us back, right?
Right.
The Beatles were signed to EMI, yeah? My producer, George Martin, via EMI's Parlophone label. Listen to this George Martin story that I found out. I've not heard it before. Maybe someone will say, I knew about that, but I've not heard this before. And I introduced some more mind control and more proof of the controlling pattern that runs through the show and shenanigans that goes on. And more hooks the link if we need it anymore. So George Martin, CBE, was the Beatles' record producer, arranger, composer, conductor, and he was also a musician. That was from Wikipedia, that. Producer, arranger, composer, conductor, and he was a musician. Only thing he didn't put there was singer.
Even I know that. I'm not a Beatles fan at all.
He basically did everything. Mm. Martin was commonly referred to as the fifth Beatle. There's a lot of them fifth Beatles. Martin used his Army Veterans Grant to attend the Guildhall School of Music and Drama from 1947 to 1950. He studied piano as his main instrument and oboe for his secondary, being interested in the music of Rachmaninoff, Ravel, and Cole Porter. In 1948, George Martin's oboe teacher was an upper-class lady called Margaret Elliott. Elliott was a professor of oboe at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. Elliott was also an honorary member of the Royal Academy of Music. Margaret Augusta Elliott, Augusta's always, must have been a popular name back then, because I keep coming across a few names and Augusta's one of them, but anyway, in male and female. Margaret Augusta Elliott, to be exact, was born to the Honourable Edward Granville Elliott, a younger brother of the 7th and 8th Earls of St. Germain. Margaret Elliott's ancestors were the Earls of St. Germain, Marquess of Stafford, the Earls of Gower, Duke of Kingston upon Hull, Earl of Denbigh, Marquess of Dorchester, Edward Craggs Elliot, 1st Baron Elliot, Earl, and the Earls of Jersey, the Villiers family, who were also linked to the Jekyll family, and the Dukes of Buckingham, who was the favourite of King James I of England. Why is Margaret Elliot important and interesting? Well, not only did she teach oboe to the fifth Beatle, Sir George Martin, CBE, it turns out that on the 24th of July 1943, Margaret Elliot married Dr. Richard Asher.
Ah, is that the Paul McCartney's missus's dad? Right?
Yes.
Yes.
Dr. Richard Asher was the eminent British consultant in blood and mental diseases at the Central Middlesex Hospital, as well as being a broadcaster and an author of notable medical articles. Asher was a senior physician responsible for the mental observation ward. He described and named Munchausen syndrome in a 1951 article in The Lancet.
Hang on a minute, sorry. Did he come up with the Munchausen? Yes. Fucking hell, which means you basically, that's, Munchausen means you can't help but lie.
Yes.
And I've looked into that because you see,
you're going to like you
meet,
this.
Yeah. You know, when you meet loads of liars, and that is where Terry Gilliam made a film about it, the Munchausen, whatever. But yeah, go on.
Sorry. Munchausen syndrome is a factitious disorder in which those affected feign or induce disease, illness, injury, abuse, or psychological trauma to draw attention, sympathy, or reassurance to themselves.
All right. I kind of thought it was just that you were a liar. But
well,
that makes it a little bit deeper, though, doesn't it?
The difference between hypochondriacs is that people with Munchausen syndrome are skilled in deceiving medical professionals.
Right, right. Huh.
While people with hypochondria may be resistant to reassurance and may continue to worry about their health despite medical reassurance. Now, why would this be a point important for Brave New World Order? The Ashers had three children. Peter Asher, born 1944, member of the pop duo Peter and Gordon, and later became a record producer. Also, there's Claire Asher, a radio actress. I think she's an author as well. And the middle daughter was Jane Asher, born 1946, the film and TV actress and novelist. The Asher's family own a home above Peter Asher's private consulting rooms at 57 Wimpole Street, London. Where this story becomes a little odder is that, as Chris said, Paul McCartney lived there from 1964 to 1966 at the height of Beatlemania during his relationship with Jane Asher. Now, what are the odds that Sir George Fifth Beatle Martin would be taught oboe in 1947 to 49 by Jane Asher's mother at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama and then go on to be the manager of Paul McCartney's Beatles band?
Yeah, sorry, if I shouldn't have mentioned that earlier on, but
Dr. Asher's 1949 paper, Myodexodermis Madness, I'm not even going to trade it, and
what the
psychosis.
Hell does that mean? What does myodexodermis mean?
Dermatous madness or myodexodermis psychosis, a condition in where the thyroid gland does not produce enough thyroid hormones.
Right.
Another modern day autoimmune disease issue. Yeah. So what they're saying is because your thyroid hormones aren't being produced, that you can actually get, and this is true, it can affect your mood.
Yeah? Right.
On February 11th, 1956, Peter Asher published a paper called Respectable Hypnosis. In the paper, under the heading The State of Hypnosis, you tell me if this sounds like MKUltra / Manchurian Candidate program. It reads, under deep hypnosis, the subject automatically obeys any suggestions made by the hypnotist. For instance, if you suggest that he cannot move, he is virtually paralyzed. But if you suggest that he can move, then he does. If you suggest that he will obey your requests, then others can command him in vain. But if you suggest that he will obey other people, then he will be obedient to them. Those phenomena which can be induced under deep hypnosis include paralysis, rigidity, anesthesia, automatic obedience, delusions, somnambulistic, which is trance, post-hypnotic suggestion, and post-hypnotic amnesia. Somnambulistic trance is where a person will walk, talk, or do complex actions while asleep. Under hypnosis, a patient can be requested to open his eyes, walk about, talk, and in fact behave like a normal conscious person. On waking from his trance, he will have no recollection of anything he has said or done. This was from a 1956 paper that Peter Asher read. It's on the National Institutes of Health National Library of Medicine at PubMed. That's a snippet from it.
That sounds suspicious, like mind control.
Again, what are the odds that Sir George Martin who has three beetles on his coat of arms, was taught oboe by Margaret Elliot Asher, and then Martin would go on to produce, manage Sir Paul McCartney and the Beatles while he was going out with Jane Asher. And Peter Asher studied mind control via hypnosis and had Paul McCartney living with him for 2 years.
Yeah.
By the way, in the early 1960s, probably while living at the Asher home, Margaret Elliot also taught Paul McCartney to play the recorder, which he later used to effect in the recording of a few of his songs, including The Foot on the Hill. According to McCartney, the song possibly, so he can't remember, relates to a character such as the Maharishi Yogi, who we mentioned in episode 2, Twilight Language, the Beatles' meditation teacher. In 1964, Richard Asher suddenly gave up his job at the hospital and perhaps all his medical activities. This was the same period of time that Paul McCartney lived there in a relationship with Jane.
Weird, man. That's so weird, isn't it?
While living here with his then 18-year-old girlfriend, Jane Asher, Paul wrote many of the Beatles' most famous songs, including the first American number one, I Want to Hold Your Hand, which was conceived in the basement of Jane's mother's music room. Yesterday was also written there on the family piano or in a box room at the top of the house, depends on who's telling the story. Paul said, if it's a famous story, isn't it? He famously woke up from a dream with a tune in his head and wrote it down and then asked anybody if they'd ever heard it before.
Yeah.
But I think Mike Williams showed that in that fantastic 4-hour marathon that he did about 3 years ago.
Mm.
And in, what would it call, Did the Beatles Write All Their Own Music? A presentation from April 2020. Was Dr. Asher part of a Tavistock MKUltra operation? I mean, we'll never know, because Dr. Richard Asher suffered from depression himself in later life. Well, not just later life, a few years on. And reportedly died by suicide on 25th of April 1969, aged just 57. His death took place at the same place, 57 Wimpole Street, the home he shared with Sir James Paul McCartney MBE, approximately 3 years after McCartney lived there. Did Dr. Asher suffer from the same kind of mental illness that Dr. Ewan Cameron's MKUltra experiments were proving? Cameron argued that people with mental illnesses could spread and transmit their diseases.
Right, fucking hell, what?
Yeah. He called it mental contagion.
We've seen a bit of that, I suppose, recently.
Yeah. Or did he know too much about the 1966 death of Paul Mark I? Was this the reprogramming of New Paul?
Yeah. I would guess, I mean, I'm making this up because I don't know, but it looks like his missus was brought in to drag in Paul Mark One, and then, MKUltra. And what a bizarre story, that is bizarre.
Yeah. And the reason I got into that, because many of the characters are attached to these. I mean, that Peter Asher could have just been easily knocked off, couldn't he? For all we know. But many of the characters attached to Huxley's that we're covering throughout this series and beyond are members of the cover of the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Would I be right in saying that Asher went missing and they didn't find him, and then they found him in the basement?
And they found him in the bathroom, as usual, I think. But I might be wrong there.
But I think I think one of the stories was he went missing, they didn't find, and then they found him in his own
right,
house.
Okay. Right, because you do. That's what happens. You go missing. Yeah. They can't find you anywhere. Then you're in your own house.
I think so. Anyway, sorry.
But anyway, whatever. It's an odd story. That,
it's a
isn't it?
Bizarro story. And like you said, you've just added to Mike Williams' already bizarro story with a bit of mob, the trombone.
I hope he listens to that bit, because I hope he likes that, because these little things get you going. I don't want to do me. I'm a bit of a geek now, sadly, a train spotter, but they do get you. But that just the coincidence, no, the laws of possibility of Jane Asher's mum, before she was Jane Asher's mum, teaching Sir George Martin. It's 20 years before he was the Beatles.
If you took
manager.
Everything you've mentioned in the last half an hour, right, and said they all lived in the same village, it'd kind of be all right.
Yeah.
But they don't, do they?
No. And not only that, it's not even the same time zone.
Yeah, exactly. But if they all lived on the same street at the same time, then it kind of might balance out, but it didn't work like that, does it?
No.